Hello and welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me in a bit for this week's review will be Candice LaPage, and we're going to review something we don't usually, a type of movie we don't usually do here on the show, something very small and inoffensive. And a lot of fun and emotional, kind of soapy. We'll see how we think about it, but it feels like it's timely. Not necessarily the topic of the movie itself is timely, but you know, just sort of chilling out, enjoying a nice, you know, kind of warm, cozy, comfort food of a movie that doesn't test your assumptions or bombards you with special effects and things. It's going to be really quite refreshing, I think. Anyway, End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 3 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new romantic drama, If Not Now, When?, which is now streaming on premium VOD platforms. That is in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to do some movie news. We haven't done some movie news in a while, so seems like a good time to, scroll through the pages of the World Wide Web and see what's going on in the realm of movie news. January is a pretty quiet time. People coming back from the holidays, readjusting. On the other hand, it can be a very busy time because January is typically when award season picks up. Usually around this time, we would be getting the Golden Globes. But all of that has been delayed because of COVID-19. I can't remember off the top of my head exactly when the Golden Globes are. I know the Oscars are in April. And usually the Golden Globes take place about a month beforehand, the Oscars. But like I said, I don't really think they've even announced the nominees for the Golden Globes yet. Having said that, though, among my news pieces this week is some Oscar news. And in a couple of cases, this is regarding sort of the less famous categories. The shortlist for the Best International Features Award, they're doing 15 this year, which is a bit unusual. Usually they, when they're shortlisting things, you eventually get 5 nominees, and they usually shortlist 10, and then from there they work from the 10 to choose 5. This is a little bit different this year, obviously, because of COVID. The way this usually works is a committee of people who are in charge of these nominations get together. They choose like 7 that will become like sort of the formal finalists. Plus, they have a panel of sort of, I guess, people who have certain expertise in international films whose job it is to choose 3. And typically these are 3 movies that might have get missed otherwise. And so that's how you get the 10. Except this year, they are not meeting, because this is an in-person meeting. They usually have to choose the 7 that the members of the Academy Board choose. But because they would have to be required to have this a virtual meeting, like on Zoom or some other platform, and Zoom is not, like, completely secure, I guess is what I'm looking for. There have been instances where people have hacked Zoom meetings, and obviously if you're having a meeting about the Oscars, that would probably be an attractive meeting to hack, even if it is about the Best International Film category. So, just for the sake of, I guess, making sure things are more secure than usual, they're kind of foregoing some of these usual festivities and meetings and things, and are doing things in a more holistic way. So that's why you get 15, a short list of 15 instead of a short list of 10. Of course, it'll remain to be seen if Deepa Mehta's Funny Boy is one of the 15 shortlisters. Funny Boy is, of course, the Canadian selection for the Best International Film Award this year. In other Oscar news, there are a record number of documentaries up for this year's award, 240. That is about 70 more than the previous record holder, which was 170. And I think that was in 2017. It was 2017, 2016. It was only a couple of years ago, because there has been because of streaming platforms, documentaries have sort of been flowing more freely. Typically, though, the rules are kind of strict, you know, because it's the Oscars, obviously, but you have to have some kind of film festival run. You have to have some kind of film release on the big screen. They changed the rules for documentaries somewhat this year. So, documentaries that were chosen for at least two film festivals, even if those film festivals didn't go forward, if a documentary had won an award at one of the festivals, or if there had been Academy screening set up within 60 days of them being released on VOD. So I guess because of these sort of looser rules, there are now 240 contenders, potential contenders for the best feature documentary. Of course, these things get shortlisted too. And it has been an interesting year for documentaries. Over the weekend, they had the International Documentary Association Awards, and Crip Camp won Best Picture. So, I'm not sure how much people pay attention to the pre-Oscar documentary awards. Maybe that's a sign that Crip Camp is going to be a Oscar contender, or maybe even win a strong possibility to win the Best Documentary Oscar. Dick Johnson is Dead is also a possibility. It won two awards at the IDAs. These are worth noting because you can watch these documentaries easily enough on Netflix. So it's going to be interesting this year to see if there might be some more interest in that category just because of how easily the main contenders are accessible. We'll have to see. Speaking of things going to streaming, Skydance, which is a production company, they work a lot with Paramount Pictures. They've been co-producers on things like the Star Trek movies and the Mission Impossible movies. They have sold the streaming rights for Heart of Stone, or they're in the process of they have definitely sold the streaming rights for this one to Netflix. This is a film that stars Gal Gadot, and it's kind of like a female-centric action movie that's kind of being billed as like a strong kind of Mission Impossible-style franchise that could get going. We'll have to see. It is from director Tom Hooper, who is not unaccustomed to this because his last film, The Aeronauts, was sold to Amazon, and it streamed on Amazon and also had a limited theatrical release. But I note that because The Aeronauts was a really beautiful movie that I would have loved to have seen on the big screen, and it never got that release, sadly. So I wonder if it might be a similar thing for Heart of Stone. Also interesting to note that this is the second Gal Gadot movie to find its way going to Netflix. I can't remember its name, but it's a movie that stars her, Dwayne The Rock Johnson, and Ryan Reynolds. So that's coming forward to Netflix this year, too. It's also interesting to note Skydance was also producing another movie called The Tomorrow War, which is being produced and stars Chris Pratt. It is currently, it's likely going to go to Amazon Prime. There was some interest from Apple, from what I understand in my research. But The Tomorrow War is another film that looks like it's going to go to streaming too. And on top of all this, No Time to Die, which is the next James Bond movie, there's rumors on the internet that it is going to be moving from its current April release date to a November release date, which will be the fourth time there's been a move in the release for that movie because of COVID, obviously. It moved from last April to November, and then when COVID didn't clear up, they moved it to this coming April, and now like the warning signs are there because the UK, which usually opens the James Bond movie a week before the US and other markets, UK is now in its third lockdown. So I mean, April, when you look on the face of it, is only 13 weeks away. So it's not that in the far future. It's not impossible to think that, you know, we're still going to be having, if not the stringent lockdown restrictions we have now, certainly strong lockdown restrictions going into April. And they've been extremely hesitant, putting No Time to Die on a streamer somewhere and opening that up. I mean, there have been news stories, of course, we talked about it on this show several weeks back, that Netflix and Apple were both looking to buy No Time to Die for the streaming service, but the price tag from MGM is too high because a James Bond movie is easily going to make $1 billion. One last bit of streaming news, shall we say. Godzilla vs. Kong is moving up 2 months. this would be the 6th release date change for Godzilla vs. Kong. I don't know if this is... If it's going to be released in Canada, because this is one of these deals where it's being released on HBO Max simultaneously as it's being released in theaters in the United States. We know that Wonder Woman 1984 is available on premium VOD platforms for a premium price. They might do the same for Godzilla vs. Kong. We'll have to wait and see. Well, let's plow through some of the rest of this news here. John Carpenter, which you may know the names, you may certainly know the movies, Assault on Precinct 13, Halloween, The Thing, The Fog, Escape from New York, Escape from LA. Anyway, he hasn't made a movie in over 10 years. His last movie was called The Ward. It came out in 2011. It's not his best, but it's not too shabby either. He's been largely, I guess, living large off royalties from remakes of his films in the last 20 years or so. But apparently he has signed a deal with his wife, Sandy K. Carpenter. They are going to be making podcasts and other sort of narrative horror shows for the audio platform Serial. And that does sound interesting. I mean, John Carpenter is not a new figure, I guess, to the art of the oral, the A-U-R version of oral. He has been making or co-writing the music for his films. He recently co-wrote the music for the Halloween, I guess, Legacy Quill from 2018. I believe he was doing that again for the Halloween Kills, which comes out later this year. So now he's going to be doing podcasts and things with a horror bent. That sounds very interesting. I've been recently investigating the possibility of doing a sort of a John Carpenter run the series, which requires me to watch or rewatch quite a few movies. But that would be fun. I would like to revisit some John Carpenters. Speaking of revisiting things, Kevin Smith recently went on social media and said that he finished the first draft of Clerks 3 and is hopeful that he might make that happen soon. I would take this with the meagerest grain of salt, or perhaps the largest pile of salt, because, I mean, Kevin Smith is a great one for talking about projects he's working on. I believe this is the third or fourth time he's talked about writing Clerks 3 or getting down to writing Clerks 3 or working on Clerks 3. Famously in 2019, he was, I guess, pretty close to moving forward with Clerks 3. But one of the actors from Clerks, Jeff Anderson, decided he didn't want to do it. Apparently he's back in. I'm not going to hold my breath. This is one of those things like the Avatar sequels where it's like, I'm going to wait until I'm in the theater with the lights and going low and then seeing the credits come up and then going, oh, okay, now I'm watching Clerks 3. Because, I mean, there's the Mallrats sequel, which has never materialized. One of his Canadian-themed horror movies he's never materialized. There was that hockey movie he was going to do, Hit Somebody, which was then going to be a TV show. No, then it was a movie again, and then he never did it. And I mean, I remember being at a Kevin Smith press conference when he was in Toronto with Red State. This was back in, I want to say, 2010? And he spent like half an hour talking about Hit Somebody, which is a movie that never happened. So that's life in the covering of Kevin Smith. One thing you definitely will not see is the character Cyborg in the Flash movie. If the Flash movie itself ever gets made, that's another story altogether. But Ray Fisher, who played Cyborg in the Justice League movie, came out and said that he will not be in Flash. It seems that the studio Warner Brothers has opted not to use him in that movie. There has always been this rumor that his character would next appear in the Flash movie. Of course, I'll say again, famously, Ray Fisher's been embroiled in this thing with Warner Brothers over the allegations against Joss Whedon having an unsafe works set. Ray Fisher's been largely unsatisfied with Warner Brothers' response. He came out a few months ago and said he would never again work with Walter Hamada, who is the current head of Warner Brothers Pictures. And I guess he's getting his wish. Maybe to wrap up, I do enjoy this. They announced that there is a Risk TV series coming from the man who created the American version of House of Cards, Bo Willimson. I have no idea what this this show is going to look like. I mean, if you've ever played Risk, it's a strategy game using Napoleonic era armies taking over the world. I don't know how you turn this into a weekly TV show. I mean, they've also done several different versions of Risk, from like theme Risk, like Star Wars Risk and other things, to futuristic Risk. So is this, like, what is this going to be? What is it going to look like? It seems crazy to me that they're turning this board game into a TV show. It's not even like straightforward like Battleship. I mean, that Battleship movie was horrible, but at least it kind of got down to the concept of Battleship after you have to, you know, watch what's his name? Taylor Critch? Yeah, like mope for an hour about how he, you know, doesn't shape up as a sailor. And being in love with Liam Neeson's daughter, and how his big brother Alexander Skarsgård was a better man than him. I can't believe I remember that much from that Battleship movie, but there you go. Enough about board games being turned into things that aren't board games. Let's get into the movie review this week, which is If Not Now, When? And If Not Now, when do we get start this review? Well, in a few minutes, after our musical break. You are listening to end credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
Garage last week.
Oh my God. That was once. And besides, I have a prescription for these pills.
You hurt your back last year. You should not still be taking those pills, Tyra.
Okay, well, Patrice, you don't know my pain.
Love, one of my dancers on tour hurt her ankle. She wasn't...
Teacher, please stop with the dance stories. Just... You guys, I am fine. I'm fine.
You OD'd. People that OD are not fine, Tyra.
Okay, and I don't need you to fix this.
But that seems to be my job when it comes to you.
And that was a clip from If Not Now, When? It is the new film from directors Tamara Bass and Megan Good, and it stars Megan Holder, Tamara Bass, Makia Cox, Edwin Hodge, McKinley Freeman, and Megan Good. I am now being joined on the line by Candace LaPage. Candace, how are you today?
I'm doing all right. I have a croak in my throat, whatever we call it, because I don't talk to people anymore.
You haven't talked to anyone since we recorded the last, the end of the year show. You've been just, it's just been saving up for about a month now.
Yep, yep. And on top of that, I'm not even talking to myself enough here, home, alone, in my apartment.
That's all right. I've been talking to myself a lot lately. And I have some very interesting opinions on current events. Anyway.
I'm sure you do. And I look forward to hearing them on your next episode of a different show.
Yes, tomorrow's show. Well, that's a good segue for If Not Now, When, which is the movie of the week and a pertinent question for our time. But Candace, you selected this, so you get to kick it off by talking about why, if not now, when?
Sure. So, you know, January's not a typical, it's not usually blockbusters coming out in January, so it's always a little tough to find things. And certainly there have been years that I think there have been really good films that come out in January that I wonder why they didn't come out earlier, because they you know, I feel like January is kind of where the industry dumps some things. So, you know, it was a little tough. And on top of that, of course, we're not really doing new releases. Things are coming out VOD. And I still have not really found a very good way of finding out, like, what's coming out when. And maybe I should just start looking at the trades a little bit more. But I look at a couple of things. Like, there are some blogs I have that tell me, like, what's coming to Crave in Canada and what's coming to Netflix in Canada. So I found If Not Now, When actually through Apple, just going through the like new releases or upcoming releases. And you know what? It felt like the kind of movie that I wish I watched more of. It's written and directed by women. It's a drama. It's focusing on four, you know, Black women. And I recognize that that's just not naturally sort of where I go when I, when I'm trying to find things to watch. And I should, I feel like I should be a little bit more intentional about it. I spent, maybe it was 3 years ago, I decided I was going to try to do the 52 films by women, which I did not achieve. It's not that it's not possible. It's absolutely possible. There are lots of women who are, you know, directing movies, producing movies, writing movies. It's just that so many of them don't really fall into my typical wheelhouse of entertainment. So I figured, you know what? Look at this. This is written and directed by women, and it's about Black women, and it's outside of my wheelhouse. So let's watch it. What's the worst that can happen? There's very little worse. There's very little bad that can happen. Believe me, I've watched films that are within my wheelhouse that have been a complete and total waste of time. So watching a drama is not going to be a bad thing.
No, it's you're right. What you're saying is there hasn't been any like real blockbusters in a while. It's like even when they try to release blockbusters in this environment, like Tenet or Wonder Woman, they, you know, they're not really blockbusters. It's just another thing on streaming, it feels like. Maybe that's too bad. I mean, but I think it's also the atmosphere now. It sort of makes it easier to for something like this to stand out. Because I guess it's the streaming equivalent of doom scrolling. It's, you know, there's the stuff you would normally seek out, like the new blockbusters, just aren't there. So if you want to watch something new that just came out, what kind of rises to the surface in the new release column ends up being stuff that you would not probably typically seek out or engage with. And I think this is one of those.
And you know, I don't want it to sound like this wasn't a good movie, or I didn't enjoy it, or that, you know, that it shouldn't have been released or anything like that. None of that is true. It's just the reality is that I just typically don't watch these types of movies. And even when I do go into sort of the drama realm, I tend to be more of a coming of age sort of show, which of course we've watched a lot of teen melodrama because I enjoy that. So watching something about, you know, four adult women having adult lives and adult relationships and
adulting.
And none of them did dishes, I don't believe.
No.
Or laundry for that matter. So I think they failed at adulting.
No, nobody in this movie does housework because they have way too much time to just like sit around and chew the fat. It's interesting. I assume housework does get done, but I mean, this is kind of one of those movies too where people have all the time in the world to marinate on their drama and spend significantly less time on, you know,
work.
Housework. Well, also, yeah, that work. We only ever see work when it's sort of like pertinent to the scene, like the character who's the choreographer, Deirdre. Mm-hmm. You know, when she's working late, and her ex-husband is concerned, like that's a scene. But we don't just see her like, you know, working just as a matter of fact. Yeah. Anyway,
though, I do believe the actual time frame of this film is that it is happening over summer. So, you know, a lot of us don't work as much in summer and do a lot more socializing in summer. So it's fine.
Well, fair enough. To piggyback on what you were saying, like, this is a movie not in my wheelhouse either. I probably would have let it pass by if you had not suggested it. But I also think too that, I mean, aside from the value in highlighting the work of Black filmmakers and Black female filmmakers, I think that there's also value in just sort of like appreciating these sort of like slice of life kind of movies, these kind of I don't know, you know, these kind of, you know, melodramatic movies where everybody's problems are deeply personal but absolutely huge, and you know, just sort of I guess bathing in the relatively laid back, I mean, relative to sort of what we're doing, you know, here in this day and age where people are concerned about, you know, the pandemic taking their job or having to go out to work in a pandemic or, you know, the myriad of other concerns like going to work at the U.S. Capitol and having insurrectionists try and kill you. You know, this is kind of escapism in and of itself to just, you know, to enjoy these people dealing with serious, but, you know, in the grand scheme of things, relatively minor problems. Like, does this guy I'm dating, you know, he wants kids, but I can't have kids, or the father of my child is a hound dog who is, you know, insatiable, and I have to throw him out. And, you know, these kind of like these kind of melodramatic things that, it's. The solutions to these problems are relatively easier. I mean, and it's also taking a place against the backdrop of, you know, warm, summery, sunny California weather where people sort of, you know, luxuriating, taking long walks, nobody's wearing a mask, hanging out outside. It's, I mean, at this point, yeah. This is as much fantasy as Lord of the Rings, but I kind of dug it.
Yeah. Yeah. And so just to give sort of a quick like recap of what's happening. So it's four high school friends, sort of fast forward about 15 years, and some of them are still quite close. Some of them have sort of drifted apart. But one of the four friends, Tyra, turns out she has become addicted to painkillers, which were prescribed to her for a back injury, and she accidentally overdosed, and her friends have come together to help her make sure she gets some help.
Intervention. And,
yeah. So we see sort of three of the friends kind of come back together and get to know each other a little bit more and get to know each other in a way that is actually sort of an intimate friendship way and not in that sort of, kind of weak ties, right? Where you see people post their updates on Facebook and go, oh yeah, my friend, but you don't really know what's going on. You just know what they're showing the world. And then there's some young people involved because the woman who had the opioid addiction has a daughter. So, we get a variety of sort of stories, of one woman trying to understand how she became an addict, one woman trying to understand how she became, the almost like an influencer, the person who shows the perfect world but lives in chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, it was a nice film to watch, I think, because I think you sort of put it well when you say, it's lush summer, people are hanging out, nobody's wearing a mask. It just feels like, wouldn't it be kind of nice to just be in this world with these people, even though four different women are all having fairly significant moments in their lives, which, right, will change the future. Seems a little, maybe that's why they make such good friends. They're totally in sync.
Yeah, no, it's soapy, which I appreciated because, I mean, when you're talking about these slice of life things, I was thinking a lot about This Is Us, the TV show, which I haven't watched a lot of because it's kind of tragedy porn, because it's not just about, it's not just about, this is our lives and this is what we're doing. There's, constant tragedy. And when they run out of tragedy, some deep buried tragedy from the past suddenly rears its head. And so it's a constant state of emotional churning and emotional grist for the mill. But this, it's like these problems are easy to understand. It hasn't resulted in anyone dying. Well, yet in the case of the one woman, Tyra, who did accidentally overdose. But I mean, we see her, although she struggles to recover and overcome addiction, she is clearly dedicated to doing the work, and she is trying her best. There's no horrible trips to the hospital for stomach pumping or something. it's very kind of, I don't want to say laid back, because I don't think anything's really laid back, but it's just sort of like, I can handle these problems. I can watch these people handle these problems without feeling like I'm kind of like interloping, watching people suffer emotionally. And so I did enjoy that, the soapiness of it. Again, it feels very escapist, even though I'm not sure that was the intent, but it in sort of like thinking about things that aren't dire, and watching people deal with problems that aren't the end of the world. It just felt nice.
Yeah. And I do think, as you say, that wasn't really the plan when they made it. Of course, they didn't know what sort of year we were going to have in 2020. It's important to note that it was written and directed by two of the actresses who make up the foursome, and directed by one of them. And, it's very clear. And even as I watched it, and I didn't realize who wrote it or directed it, but even as I watched it, I did sort of feel like, wow, this just feels like an avenue these women have to explore really good, interesting characters who are, like you say, not full of trauma, not full of, none of these problems are life or death. They're all pretty standard problems that most women go through or know someone who's gone through. They're all pretty standard. And so, you know, it felt like a vehicle for these four actresses to be able to just really play like a normal character or a character that would be like themselves. I found it interesting. So the actress who plays Patrice, Tamara or Tamara, I'm not sure, and also Bass or Bass, I also don't know how to pronounce her first or her last name. So let's go with Tamara Bass. So
that sounds fine.
Yeah. So I really quite liked her. But I found in this foursome, she sort of stuck out. And this is not to say that she is not attractive or anything. But the other three are that very Hollywood conventional way that Black actresses are beautiful, right? Mm. That they have those finer features. Whereas Tamara Bass, Patrice, is shorter than all the other women. Her hair is far more natural. The other ones all tend to have like relaxed hair. Hers was, you know, just like an afro or very crimpy. And you know, she just has like a cute round face. She doesn't have that sort of traditional, you know, like Vanessa Williams type look.
Right.
And I suspect that she, and I did sort of look into it a little bit. But so as an actress, I'm sure she never gets called back for anything. Mm. Right. Because she's not, stereotypically like funny enough or fat enough or whatever enough to be kind of the sassy Black best friend. And she doesn't have that look that is going to be the like, oh yes, we could see one of our leading white men actors with this woman. Like she just doesn't fit into the two roles that Hollywood has for Black women.
Right.
And so I'm sure she was just like, you know what? And her character was great, right? She was a nurse. She was motherly. She was a best friend. She had this amazing sort of relationship with this very handsome doctor who absolutely pursued her, you know? And it was... yeah, it felt like the sort of thing that's just like, I feel like she's just like, you know what? I can play this character too. Right? Mm-hmm. I can have the good job. I can get the guy. I can have the complicated, you know, sort of reason why I'm pushing people away. Like, I can see that.
No, you're right. And it's interesting too. It's Tamara Bass and Megan Good. Megan, they directed it, and Tamara Bass wrote the script. I found it interesting that they kind of took the least flashy parts. I assume they kind of had their choice of casting themselves as whichever character they would like, but they chose the kind of the least flashy part. Like, there's kind of one of the things I enjoyed about the film is the actress who played Suzanne, who's the one who's married to the ex football player. What's her name? I'm trying to find it. Mikia Cox. And there are a couple of scenes that are like straight out of soap opera acting school, where it involves like smashing a TV and then like tearing apart the house of all the husband's possessions when he eventually files for divorce. And it's like, that could have been over the top, but she plays it just right. Like, when she smashes that TV, it doesn't feel like a moment. It feels like in the moment, not a moment. It just feels like natural in that moment. She smashes that TV, and she does it with conviction, and she does it with kind of like no afterthought, like, oh my god, I'm smashing a TV.
it's just that actress was really, really good in those two scenes, which could have gone hammy so easily. But I was thinking a lot about Megan Good because she's turned up in a, I mean, she's done a lot of work. She's kind of one of these actresses who was almost like that, like the lead actress level. Like she would appear in a lot of these like movies as kind of like a second lead. Like she was in The Love Guru. I'm just looking at her IMDb. She was like in Stomp the Yard. Like she was in a variety of things where she was like the love interest, but she never like kind of reached the leading woman level of like, let's say, Halle Berry. Mm-hmm. And so to see her here kind of taking not only the least flashy part, but also like kind of like the most introspective and kind of the most, like there's a lot of scenes where this is kind of where I have like kind of two competing thoughts about it, because there's a lot where going on with Tyra's inner life and why she's an addict and how and how she's struggling to recover that I think could have been better served if we saw more of it instead of having her monologue about it, because that's one of the things about the film that kind of makes it feel like it was a play that ended up going nowhere. But at the same time, she acts it really, really well, and it feels like kind of like a showcase for her. This part that requires her to be in solitude away from the rest of the cast for a while, or with the actor who's playing the therapist, or with like a group of extras that's supposed to be her, you know, recovery group. It very much seems like she's making a statement, an artistic statement about like, hey, yo, this is what I am capable of, and maybe you guys missed out on something with me here. And I think that plays into Tamara Bass casting herself as Patrice, which is another role that is, her issues are kind of more deep-seated. Her struggles are kind of more deep-seated. It's not like there's kind of no confrontation. It's much more nuanced than that. And I feel like it's, as you were kind of alluding to, it's a statement on these two women, for different reasons, and you outlined sort of your insights into what Tamara Bass might have been thinking. But, you know, they're both trying to make a statement, I think, about their own artistic talents and their own artistic abilities with the parts they've played. And I was thinking a lot about that after the film, too.
Yeah. I will, however, say I think both of them make better actors than they do directors. And it's funny because, you know, I watched this film and I was really enjoying it. And then when I finished it, I sort of thought, okay, well, you know, I feel like I have a few negatives, but on the whole, I really, really enjoyed it. But the negatives are really sort of based more on the production side. First, and I noticed it right away, and it took me out of so many scenes. The handheld camera work, it's just like, why? Like, I think I know why. I think you're doing it because you want us to feel like we're right there in the room. We're, you know, an actor in this story, not just watching it. But yeah, a lot of the handheld work really took me out of it. And, you know, and I don't have any tips on how to fix this next thing, but it was too long. You know, like I was going along just fine. And then I was just like, I just hit a wall all of a sudden where I was like, I really need a snack. And I don't feel like this movie is anywhere near finishing up yet. I've got to pause it and go make myself some popcorn.
Right.
And it was like, it was an hour and 51 minutes, which is very long for a slice of life. You know, like, sure. Yes. I will say that, there were definitely, there was still a plot. There was still, you know, a conflict and introduce more conflicts and all the thing we learned about story structure in, you know, high school literature, mm-hmm. and coming up to, you know, a conclusion. But, you know, whether it was because they were trying to make sure that all four women each had that, including, and I will say also including Tyra's daughter as well, Jillian, mm-hmm. Who also was a very strong character and actress too in this mm-hmm. film. And she really did, you know, she didn't get sort of screwed out of a storyline. She very much got her own story as well. And so it just, you know, if it was maybe an hour and 35 minutes.
No, I feel that too. Like around the 1 hour, a little after the 1 hour mark, there's like a montage. And there's a kind of pattern to this where you have to these movies where you have you introduce the characters, you lay out their issues, you see them struggling with their issues. Then you hit the montage where they're improving, things are getting better. They're you know, it's like the Team America World Police song. Every you get a little bit better, and you know, then you have and then you kind of get to the third act where things sort of wrapped up. But then you get to that montage, and then there's like another 20 minutes of stuff, and then you get to another montage, and then you get into the third act, and it's just like, I think we could have shaved that extra montage and, you know, 20 minutes there. But although I like you, I did enjoy the Jillian storyline and the boy she meets in dance class. Having said that, I think that's probably about 20 minutes you could have shaved. But in order to focus on the other four women, but I mean, I feel you too. The other thing you mentioned, the handheld stuff, that's something I feel that's a very specific choice that the directors are making. Like, we don't want to like, they recognize that there were melodramatic elements, I think, didn't want to shoot it like melodrama. There's scenes where the camera feels very standoffish. Like it's not getting into their faces, which is what you would think in a film like this, because you'd want to get in close, take in all that emotion. And the movie seems very unwilling to get in close and take you and close that distance. It has this kind of very, I don't want to say documentary style, but it has this very standoffish style. It's like, we want to capture it, but we don't want to get into the middle of it. It feels, you know, kind of the way I guess certain documentarians think you have to have that distance. And I feel like as directors, they're like, we got to have distance because we got to see the whole thing. And the style doesn't quite match. Yeah.
It's interesting that you said documentary, because when I was, you know, watching some of the scenes that really jarred me with the like handheld right there, I felt that it was really reality TV style. So I think it's somewhere in between those two is where they were maybe aiming for. And
yeah. I mean, and it's just, you're right. The weak part is the technical parts. I mean, I think they're both first time directors, so things like that I can forgive. And you know, you're trying to find your style. You know, your first film is rarely a masterpiece, if ever. And yeah, it just, I think there's more good here than outweighs the bad. And I've read some reviews of this where people really take the technical aspects of this film to the woodshed, and it's like, okay, they're not making Mank. It's it's like, you know, I recognize Megan and Tamara are no David Fincher, but you know, maybe we can cut them some slack, because you know, this film made me laugh. You know, I like how it's, you know, there are so many male characters in this film who aren't, you know, perfect princes, but they're not, you know, irredeemable d-bags either. You know, it's there's you know, you see good people trying their best and struggling with their issues. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And I think there's kind of a, and I also like how it just it you know, it leaves stuff in the air. You know, it leaves on a particular note where we think that the friends are going to a certain place, but there's nothing definitive. You know, I want to highlight this too, because I surprisingly enjoyed this portion of the movie. Suzanne, I think I liked her character the best, but Suzanne, when she eventually turfs her husband, she changes the locks and he's going around the house trying to, you know, trying different doors. And she has carefully laid out his stuff. This isn't a scene where, like we see with movies, where the woman who has been done dirty, where she throws all the stuff out in the lawn. She has carefully folded his things, put them in bags, and has left them on the patio, on a bench on the patio for him to just collect and put in his car and leave.
And I'm cold, like, and meticulous.
It is cold and meticulous, and I loved it. And yeah. That was great. And it just little touches like that, you know, it made me giggle.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I would agree, actually. I really liked her entire story from beginning to end, because it goes in unexpected places. And I like the fact that this movie, you know, even as you said with the male characters, like there really are no stereotypical characters here. And there isn't always the expected outcome,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
which was nice.
Mm-hmm.
The only other thing that I have to say about this movie that was a negative for me, but could be a positive for other people, is that it is set to a very 90s style R&B soundtrack. And if you're into that, you're going to love it.
Yeah.
I, however, feel that particular style of R&B is about, like, to me, that every time I hear a song in that style, I think it must be a parody of that style of music. Because it is so much.
Yeah, I actually thought that too. I could have swore the soundtrack was produced by Kenneth Babyface Edmonds, but it it was not. Because it certainly would have fit in that oeuvre. And if this had been made in the 90s, he definitely would have, and it definitely would have been mentioned in the trailer. And I can't find any. I mean, the music, I don't think the music especially stood out to me, but it neither bothered me or really intrigued me either.
Yeah.
Anyway.
You just don't have the same reaction I do to that R&B. You know,
apparently.
Some people just can't handle jazz. Some people can't handle country. I love both of those styles of music. I just, 90s R&B just doesn't work for me.
Well, you know, you can't like everything, I guess, is the lesson. Although I think we both kind of like this. And if you know, in a certain mood, I think it's a fine. It's a good sit, as Dave Chen on /film might say. Anyway, Candace, if people want to talk to you about what is or is not a good sit or anything else, where can people find you on the internet?
Yes, you can find me everywhere on the internet at Cinn48, that's CINN48. The month of Hallmark movies is over, so my Twitter account looks more like it always has in the past. So, you know, if you were on a holiday diet, as in I don't want any holiday stuff, you can now come back to my Twitter account.
Very good. Are you on any other podcasts, should I ask?
I am, in fact, actually. Thank you for asking, Adam. I am a co-host of the Village podcast by The Bookshelf, and there should be a new episode out this week that you can tune into to hear, you know, about what your favorite local independent bookstore in Guelph is up to.
And that's it for this week's show. We hope you liked it, and if you want to listen to it again, you can find it on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can download it from the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday at Podbean. Get it through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify.
And speaking of Spotify, you can find the playlist for all the music you hear on the End Credits show on Spotify. Just search for End Credits on CFRU and click play. You can find us on social media on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show and on Twitter at End Credits Radio. I will be back tomorrow at 5 p.m. on CFRU for News and Politics on Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. In the meantime, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson. I have a news and politics site at guelphpolitico.ca, and you can read my writing about horror movies at Nightmare on Film Street at nofspodcast.com. And stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We will be back next Wednesday at 3 p.m. for more End Credits, and we will see you then.